For several years, I traveled annually to Syracuse, New York, for meetings of the St. Lawrence Foundation Board. This board gives out grants to theological schools and ministerial students. 2 years ago, during a break at a spring meeting, I strolled around the parking lot of our hotel, heading towards my car, chatting with another member of the board. He looked around and said, "It looks like there are a lot of Priuses here. That must mean there are quite a few UUs staying at our hotel." He was logically associating the hybrid, environmentally friendly car with our Unitarian Universalist concern for global warming. He proceeded to point out the location of his own Subaru, but then went on to say, "We once had a truck, and we drove into a UU parking lot. That was not good." My colleague was implying that we UUs associate pickup trucks with common laborers or bigots with shotgun racks. We may assume that anyone who operates a pickup truck would never drive into the highly educated, culturally sophisticated Unitarian Universalist Church. It reminds me of a story my wife Andrea tells about one of her brothers who once went to church in Northampton and told the person he was talking to that he was a carpenter. The person automatically assumed he was not college educated, which he is, and then directly asked him why he would ever come to a Unitarian Universalist church, since he was obviously not the right type of person, that is, a well-educated, upper-middle-class liberal. What assumptions were made about Andrea's brother? This gets to the basic question of what kind of people are attracted to our Unitarian Universalist faith. There has long been a stereotype that Unitarianism especially has attracted those people who are wealthy and educated, or what Spiro Agnew once called effete intellectual snobs. First, there is always truth in any stereotype, and with faith choices it is historically accurate that those who are more comfortable in this life will be less concerned about salvation and what will befall them in the next life. Those with few material comforts often embrace a faith that will give them solace, that they will be rewarded by God with heaven in the end. Second, we commonly say that Unitarian Universalism is a thinking person's faith. That is, one where the adherents question received truths about religion and typically will not accept statements about faith without a measure of doubt, and therefore test them in light of their own lived experience. I think most of us would agree that it's a good thing to wonder about and question what it all means. Just like the Orthodox, we are people who are desperate to make sense of the world we live in. While they may see a separation between the spiritual world and the material world, we see them as integrated, and so we attempt to find spiritual truths in all that we find around us. But our inquiring minds that want to know can lead to the exclusion of others when it comes to those who don't follow the liberal stereotype. We can make the assumption that you must be well-educated or you are narrow-minded. When a visitor comes, we may have an unspoken profile of whether or not we think they fit in. Clearly, with Andrea's brother and the guy who drives the pickup, we might say, "No, we don't want to mix with them." The question we might ask is, who do we mix with? And what happens to this UU cocktail that is shaken, not stirred? Samuel Eliot Morison, the great historian, was once president of the American Historical Association. Once, when he came to a meeting, he walked through a crowded hotel mezzanine, and dazed academics parted before him like the Red Sea. Reaching the end of the room, he turned around and walked back, and then back and forth again. A friend came up to him and asked, "Sam, what are you doing?" "Doing," Morison replied, "doing? Why, what do you think I'm doing? I'm mixing. I think that style of mixing fits a few of us. We feel obligated to be somewhere, but we don't want to talk to anybody. A couple of years ago, I wrote the most popular newsletter column I have ever written. It was a story about being an introvert, and consequently, every introvert in the church came out of the closet. In that column, I mentioned the annual Christmas party at Andover Newton Theological School. I decided to attend so I could meet people where I teach. On the appointed day, I arrived at Andover Newton. I checked my mailbox to see if any term papers had arrived. I used the restroom, and then I could no longer procrastinate. I made my way downstairs and entered the room. I quickly noticed there were no other UU adjunct faculty or students present. In fact, no one noticed my presence, and no one was wearing name tags. They all seemed to know one another and be having a good time talking to each other. Now, I am sure they are all wonderful people, but I panicked. I asked myself quickly, do I want to be here a week before Christmas meeting a room full of people I don't know? The answer was no. I left. But the incident reminded me of an important lesson about church. It's extremely difficult to be a newcomer. It takes a great deal of courage to go to church and confront a room full of people. What do I say? Will they like me? Every person who comes through our door is thinking these thoughts with some level of fear or anxiety. They want to find a community to connect to, but they need to be invited in. They may be an introvert like me or you. Now bear in mind that I was walking into a party where every person worked for an academic and religious institution. What better setup could I have had? And I still ran. The point is that it is hard to speak to newcomers who are like us. If it is hard to speak to newcomers who are like us, what do we do with those who we perceive are not like us? The carpenters and the pickup truck drivers. Do we simply drive them away by telling them they don't belong here anyway? Or do we reach inside of ourselves to live out a religious imperative to welcome the stranger? Because by doing so, we are taking the risk that each one of us might be transformed into a more open, loving person as we invite others into deeper relationship with each other and with the world. I think the question we might ask is, who do we mix it up with? I tried to get some historical perspective on this when I wrote my book on class issues and UUism. William Ellery Channing and the other early Unitarians in Massachusetts were operating from a big umbrella theory of faith. Rather than be rigid about theological dogmas and creeds, the Unitarians wanted to focus on having a broad fellowship that was centered on how you treat others, not on what you believe. It was to be a theologically and sociologically inclusive church, unmarked by creed or class. Of course, that was true because it was the church for the whole town. In theory, the early Unitarians wanted to mix it up with others. And in fact, many towns here in Massachusetts, that is the kind of churches they had in the early 19th century. I think that was true here in West Roxbury as well. You had Unitarians and Trinitarians mixed together until 1836, when the Orthodox members could not take the broad church concept any longer and withdrew. But they also had the freedom to withdraw because the state church had finally been disestablished in 1833. I grew up in New Salem, Massachusetts, in the central part of the state, and there the minister in the early 1800s said that the differing theological groups were all mixed together. While this may seem like a diverse church to us today, the Trinitarians then were not too thrilled with the idea of mixing with heretics permanently. Like so many other towns in the Commonwealth, the struggle to have one Christian church for the entire town based on freedom and tolerance rather than dogma or beliefs was just not possible. The Unitarians here, as elsewhere, were not able to sustain a broad institution that practiced a faith defined by how you behave and not by what you believe. The Orthodox then forced the liberals into a narrow theological box, and ever since, Unitarians have often defined themselves by the stereotype of intellectual rationalist group who only mixes with other cerebral people, who could care less about dogma, including Unitarianism, as a theological position. But our identity is based on the old vision of having a broad democratic church. The problem is that nobody wanted to play in our sandbox. And moreover, we rarely invited anyone to join us because we believed the stereotype that only intellectuals belonged. Some of our fear of evangelicalism stems from this heritage. This becomes a problem in terms of church growth or even simple maintenance when you consider that on average, I've heard that the typical Unitarian Universalist invites a friend to church once every 27 years. Even in a friendly church, there is a problem with wanting to speak to your friends, or at least the people you already know, rather than reaching out to a newcomer. We still had it in our heads that we wanted to be democratic, welcoming to all, but how could we accomplish it when we were now this narrow little group? A few weeks ago, several people from my congregation went to volunteer at the Boston Food Bank. Two members who were old friends were gabbing away in our church lobby as a new member entered the church to wait for others to arrive. This was a person the long-term members did not know, and she was a single mom who probably could have used a word of welcome. They never acknowledged her or said hello. Eventually, I went over and said, "Do you know each other? Our history says we want a broad church that welcomed all, but once we were pushed away by the Orthodox, we have never asked ourselves to return to that earliest historical call. I will welcome all. I will welcome all regardless of income, status, or place in the world by speaking to them and saying how glad I am that they are here." It could be we are a faith for only a few, not because we are a thinking person's religion, but because we have not reached out to enough other thinking people in all classes. In the early 19th century, a young woman named Lucy Barnes, the daughter of the first Universalist minister in Maine, wrote a book called The Female Christian. In that work, she wrote that human relationships provide a model for understanding our relationship with divinity. One of her arguments for universal salvation was based on the emotional bonds of friendship. Sympathy, she says, ties all hearts together, and with friends, it makes us feel each other's pain. As a result, she said she could not know heaven's joy while believing that millions were suffering in misery. So too, we must ask, how fully can we appreciate our community when we know that others need it too? Welcoming the stranger and building friendship with others brings what we may know of God to true life. And our theology says this must be with all, not just the social circle we create, or the like-minded liberals. It must be practiced in an ever-intentional manner and in ever-widening circles if we are truly to be transformed to be a people who live in love. I was reminded of how narrow this circle can become just a couple of weeks ago when we were collecting coffee to send to the troops in Afghanistan. I had a member railing against this because we liberals are against war and therefore should have nothing to do with the troops. My confession for the day is that especially since I published my book on class, I spend my time alone searching myself up on the web. This is how I learned that my colleague in Bedford, Massachusetts, John Gibbons, preached on my book. John called his sermon, "Would You Go to Heaven with a Prostitute?" This is a line from a question I raise in the book about universalist theology. Clearly, my intent in asking this is not about getting to heaven with an escort, but rather about the structure of heaven itself, the shared space. Salvation historically had been based on the notion of who could live the most spotless life in the eyes of God. The best were saved, sometimes interpreted to mean those who had achieved the most financial or social or even educational success. Universalists believed our purpose was to become more loving, and that indeed God's love would enfold us all, prostitutes as well. It was a classless heaven where there was a place for everyone. When someone knocked on the gates, we did not ask, "Did you go to college? Or do you own your own home? Or are you in the military? Or even, do you wear makeup?" There was an assumption that you belonged here, rather than a judgment or presumption, such as only an educated person would get this faith. Others are too stupid. This was a lesson the Universalists tried to impart to their Unitarian siblings, but it was not easy. Together we developed a theology that calls us to live out a faith that is truly welcoming to all. But the question remained, how do we achieve that heaven on earth? In our reading today from Jamesland, Reverend Helen Harland says that humanists believe goodness and mercy and justice come exclusively from humans. While these important connections are explained, even the minister Helen laughs at the religion as the Church of Christ with no Christ, where the dead stay dead. While it may be fun to make the jokes, it fails to reflect the seriousness with which we take the faith. We deeply consider religious questions, effectively taking religious living more seriously than most. But it is the right relationship or action we care about, not the belief or the idea. The fundamental question that Helen Harlan asks is, how do people live in the world? We liberals have often tried to make our churches broader and deeper by examining issues of gender, race, or sexual identity. But we usually have not considered issues of class. This is because we perceive the people who are from another class as being so different from us in values. We try to accept African Americans and gays who have our same perceived liberal values, but we are reticent to embrace those we see as working class or uneducated. Think of our success with the gay and lesbian community, who often look and act like your stereotypical liberal, but our failures with the African American community. A colleague who ran for UUA president many years ago told me that my first church in Palmer, Massachusetts, a small New England mill town with working class people and values, was only there for historical reasons. If we were starting a UU congregation today, he was saying, we would bypass this type of community. And the same has been said about the community where I currently serve, Watertown. He was ready to dismiss the truth that all classes have folks who are smart, inquisitive people with inquiring minds and open hearts to welcome all kinds of people. We should not sell our faith short when it comes to what we have to offer and why we want others to join us. But we must be open to change and to newcomers who are not just one of us in other guises. If we want a truly democratic faith, we need to make it personal. A couple of years ago, Malcolm Gladwell wrote an article for The New Yorker on the book To Kill a Mockingbird. He is critical of Harper Lee's portrayal of Atticus Finch because he sees Atticus as someone who does not attack the institutional racism of the society. That is, he affirms the existing structures. While institutional change may be desirable, most people's minds are changed when an issue becomes personal. Atticus befriends and defends a black man. It is more than an idea about equality and justice or diversity. He makes it personal. It is more than something in his head about his attitudes and liberal guilt. Should I spend all this time living in my own head, reflecting about whiteness or inequality, or actually trying to reach out to others who are different from me, who are not presently my friends, but could be? Churches grow because we invite in our friends. Like the cocktail metaphor, we have shaken ourselves to look at racism and homophobia, but we have not stirred ourselves to truly befriend those who are different from us, in educational level or in the workplace or even in appearance. Once upon a time, segregationists believed that even heaven was segregated so that we would not be contaminated by anyone not like us. Our faith says it would not be heaven if it were not open to all. Our faith calls us to go out into the public byways and highways and make real the dream of universalism, of sharing heaven with a prostitute, of sharing earth with strangers. John Murray once said that all his friends were from the highest to the most humble. Can we replicate that in our lives? Margaret Fuller, the great transcendentalist, once told her father, "Your reluctance to go among strangers cannot too soon be overcome. And the way to overcome it is not to remain at home, but to go among them and resolve to deserve and obtain the love and esteem of those who have never before known you. With them, you have a fair opportunity to begin the world anew." Then Unitarian Universalism can fulfill its history to be more than a faith for a few. Our closing hymn this morning is number 318. Please rise in body or in spirit and join in singing, "We Would Be One." Please be seated. Our closing words this morning are from Frederick Buechner. If we are to love our neighbors, before anything else, we must see our neighbors with our imagination as well as our eyes. That is to say, like artists, we must see not just their faces, but the life behind and within their faces. Here it is love that is the frame we see them in, where our deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet, we hear a further call. Amen.